I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. When you think of psychiatry, you may think of a couch and a doctor making thoughtful observations. My guest today says that kind of talking therapy has been replaced. These days, psychiatrists are less likely to listen than to diagnose and prescribe. And my guest, Dr. Peter Breggin, says that's all wrong. Dr. Breggin, that's a popular image of the bearded psychiatrist with wise thinking and notepad writing observations as the client, patient probes their deepest problems and thoughts. Is that historically accurate, or is that a romantic notion that we've created?
It has a limited historical accuracy. It's from the time when Freud had a big influence in psychiatry, and at that point, maybe 10% of psychiatrists had Freudian psychoanalytic training, and 90% did not. But those 10% were in New York, Hollywood, Chicago, and Washington, D.C., and had huge influence on novelists and poets and media people, movies. But at the same time, 50,000 Americans were getting lobotomized in the state mental hospitals in the 50s, and at the same time, people were getting heavily drugged and being locked up. So basically, the wise man with the pad, and it usually was a man, was for a time sort of the media edge of psychiatry. And now that's gone. Modern psychiatry realized that it couldn't compete in talking therapy with the new alternatives, the social workers who are trained in doing therapy, the psychologists, the counselors, the family therapists, and a wide variety of programs that are more aimed at helping people through educational, talking, supportive methods. So what psychiatry did, and this was actually a conscious political decision, psychiatry said, we can't compete, and especially they couldn't compete with women. Because increasingly women were deciding to go to see women for therapy. In California, it was very notable. Male psychiatrists, their offices were empty or getting empty, and women were going to social workers and psychologists who were women and whom they felt they could have a better relationship with and would be better understood by.
When is this? You said they made a political decision to find a niche.
This evolved in the 60s and the 70s, and by the early 70s, the psychiatrists are actively discussing how to win back power in the mental health profession, how to fill their offices again. And the decision was made to remedicalize mental illness, that is, to develop a public campaign through the media. The American Psychiatric Association set up a media bureau through lobbying Congress. They set up a lobbying bureau at the Psychiatric Media Association, and they did all this working together with the federal government psychiatry, National Institute of Mental Health, to propagandize the public to believing that the things that psychiatrists treat, so-called schizophrenia, manic depressive disorder, depression, anxiety, and now it's down to hyperactive kids and kids who can't concentrate in class, that all of this was biological and genetic, and therefore that psychiatry was still the leader, still the spokesman, still the person in charge. And that campaign has gone on very actively, has completely taken in the media. And it was done with drug company money, because that was another decision that was made. And there was actually a debate, which I document in my book, Toxic Psychiatry. I actually show the debate going on within the American Psychiatric Association about whether it was ethical to demand more money from the drug companies. And they finally decided that it was the only way to survive. And so on a state, county, national level, psychiatry takes millions of dollars in gifts outright, as well as in other forms of support from the drug companies. And a lot of it continues to be in order to support what psychiatry calls its educational programs, which are really selling psychiatry to America. So this is a very concerted effort. I mean, it was no different than, say, the American auto industry going down the tubes and deciding to do a whole media campaign, American cars versus Japanese cars, to put a tariff on Japanese cars so that American cars could compete. Well, psychiatry went through the whole thing of developing an economic program based on the myth that human problems are genetic and biochemical.
It's quite a charge. This is Dr. Peter Bergen. He is himself a psychiatrist, which is important to know because he is, as he has said, very critical of his own field. Dr. Bergen was educated at Harvard, taking his BA in 1958 in social relations, and then turned to medicine and went on to Case Western Reserve School of Medicine from 1958 to 1962. He is a doctor, he is a psychiatrist, he is a well-published author on the subject of psychiatry and other subjects, and he's our guest today on Conversations. You've covered a lot of territory, and I want you to go back with me first to some of the earlier things you said and some of what I think must be the earlier days of modern psychiatry. Tell us where we've been. I want to look at the old psychiatry before we think of what you call the new psychiatry. Electroshock, frontal lobotomies, restraint in mental institutions. We have an image of a mental institution in those earlier days as madhouses. Can you set the stage for me? What's the theory of psychiatry then that said lobotomies, electroshock were good?
Well, first, you're on target in what you're describing as the history of psychiatry, but not everybody's as wise as you and realizes that. A lot of people think that the roots of psychiatry were Freud. Not that I'm a Freudian, but I mean people think that the roots of psychiatry were in Sigmund Freud discovering the Oedipus complex and the unconscious and so on, and none of that's true. Freud wasn't even a psychiatrist. He developed psychoanalysis. He was a physician trained in neuropathology, in a very dry science, and he was Jewish like myself, couldn't make a living as a professor, couldn't get hired as a professor, went into private practice, and discovered that his neurology patients actually had psychological problems. And when he announced that, the psychiatrists wouldn't listen to him. So he never became a major part even of psychiatry in Europe where he lived. Only in America did he begin to have some influence in psychiatry. The history of psychiatry goes back to the state mental hospitals. Psychiatry begins with the creation of state mental hospitals during the Industrial Revolution, basically as places to house poor, indigent, mad people sometimes, but often just poor people or sick people or tuberculous people or syphilitic people, people who had no place to go. It's the welfare net, the safety net of Western society has been basically putting people in state mental hospitals. So out of that grew this awful cynicism by medical people, because they would lock up people in these hospitals. The people would get worse. The doctors would say, see, they have these terrible mental illnesses. They deteriorate, when in fact nobody could do anything but deteriorate in these settings. And out of that cynical, tragic approach grew the idea that the best we can do is control these people. And it was for massive control that electroshock was originally developed, that lobotomy was originally developed. And only in later years, when psychiatry became more PR-minded, did they decide that these things corrected imbalances or somehow helped the brain. In the beginning, it was well recognized that these were damaging to the brain and were used to subdue people.
Give me a matchbook look at a frontal lobotomy. What's happening? The frontal lobes are the source of humanity, right? That's where we think and create and worry and
That's
weep
right.
and exult.
Yeah, the frontal lobes are the final flowering of evolution. Now, our feelings require our whole brain, and thinking requires basically our whole brain. But the flowering, what makes us more able to handle things than our puppies or our cats or even chimpanzees, is that frontal part of the brain flowered more, grew more, and developed more, largely probably to facilitate us being tribal, us being social. It's really hard to be a person relating to other persons. And out of that fine-tuning of social life, probably these frontal lobes really, really developed. And in psychiatry, we have assaulted those lobes from the beginning of time by, you know, banging people in the head in various ways. It was only in the 30s, though, the 1930s, when these state hospitals got so huge that psychiatry got the idea of directly damaging the tissue itself rather than just by torturing people and dunking people and tying people up and throwing people in pits or whatever else. In the 30s came this technological advance, and insulin was given in great overdoses to people, which caused a cell death in their brains. Shock applied to the skull to give convulsions and injure brain cells. And lobotomy, where you directly would go in and sever or mutilate tissue in the frontal lobes. And this really was the revolution in psychiatry. I think it's the only revolution we've had. And the revolution in psychiatry was learning to directly assault the frontal lobes instead of just beating on the body. I'm cynical enough now to believe that that's really what's gone on.
I hear your cynicism, and I can feel it in your words, but I suppose it is the innocent in me that says, Dr. Breggin, this all sounds terribly medieval. This doesn't right. sound like a product of the 20th century.
Right. Well, what happened in the 20th century ultimately was, after the 30s and this development of this assault on the brain, all of these things actually continued. We still have a lobotomy today in limited numbers, but mostly in limited numbers because I conducted a vast campaign to stop lobotomy from coming back in the 70s. That's how I got in reform work. And they still complain now that they can't do enough lobotomies because of me. There's two or three books out trying to bring back lobotomy, claiming, darn it, we got it. One book, and this is a book by a major press, says, we've got to tell the Peter Breggins of the world to stuff it. This is a professor of neurology or psychiatry, you know, saying this in a major book, so they can go on and do their lobotomies again. So it's a pretty thin line between lobotomy and non-lobotomy. It's just a very few of us. But lobotomy still goes on. Shock still goes on. Insulin coma only in other countries, very little, if any. Or if it's going on, it's hidden in the U.S. But what we did discover was in the 50s was that we had a whole array of drugs that would produce chemical lobotomies. And those are the neuroleptic drugs that are used now in the mental hospitals, like the Psychiatric Institute, the API. And they produce a chemical lobotomy. And those are Haldol and Stelazine, Thorazine, Melaril, Prolixin, Novane, Sorrento. These drugs, Trilofan, these drugs disrupt the neurochemical functions of the frontal lobes and produce the same apathy and indifference and inability to resist, inability to fight, inability to be very crazy, inability to be very human that the lobotomy and shock treatments also produce. And along the way, they produce a very high percentage of permanent neurological damage. And in fact, the first time I came to Alaska was for a case at the API, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, the state hospital. And there was a woman who'd been given these drugs at the API, even though the hospital had been warned not to, that the drugs had already caused her to have abnormal twitches and spasms of her body. And even her clinic doctor, there was a good clinic there in the town itself, that said, no, don't give her the drugs. And yet they did. And they worsened her case, and she developed with permanent grimaces and spasms from this group of neuroleptic drugs. And in fact, I was here as an expert witness on behalf of the patient, and the jury came back with a considerable finding for the injured woman in this particular malpractice case.
This is Dr. Peter Breggin. I want to ask you what's happening in the people these drugs are given to, because I'm sure people are saying, but these people were crazy. These people mm-hmm. were having a terrible time living on this earth, and there are some negative consequences, twitches and grimaces, and people can handle that in life in exchange for some semblance of quietude.
Right.
So
Well, the drugs don't really produce quietude. The medications that tend to produce quietude are made illegal because people really like them. Marijuana spaces people out, puts them in a fog. I don't favor it. It's very hard to do therapy with somebody who's smoking marijuana, and I discourage it. Alcohol puts people in a fog that's blissful or can be blissful, and so people do it to excess. The drugs we're talking about, particularly these neuroleptic drugs, tend to give people extremely uncomfortable feelings of a variety of sorts, including being so blunted that they don't feel like they're a human being. And so people tend to resist taking these drugs, and they usually only take them in desperation or under threat. A great many, many people in Alaska and elsewhere in the U.S. take these drugs because they're afraid that they'll be put back in the state hospital again, the equivalent of the API, or they're in fact under some sort of court order to take the drugs or some threat of commitment. And the literature is just full of complaints that patients don't want to take these drugs. So it's not like they're trading tranquility for the danger of brain damage. They're actually being very heavily subdued by the drugs and often made very, very uncomfortable. Let me say, by the way, just quickly, that I'm not recommending anybody stop taking their drugs. I'm not trying to give an individual consultation here to anybody. And indeed, if you take drugs, it's not only dangerous to start them, and I do discourage people, if at all possible, not to get on most psychiatric drugs. But once you're on them, coming off can make you crazy. And that's one of the cycles that people get into. If everyone or anyone listening to me just stopped taking Haldol or Thorazine or Melaril right now or Prolixin, they could end up getting withdrawal reactions, even though my colleagues claim there are none. And one of the withdrawal reactions they can get is going crazy. So you have to be very cautious about how you end these drugs, and it should be done under supervision. If you can find responsible supervision, it should be done carefully. I wanted to make that point because these drugs are, this is not a trivial matter, starting or stopping them.
I'd like to talk later in the hour about what you sense to be appropriate solutions, alternative therapies.
Good.
Dr. Began is referring to his latest book on this subject, which is called Toxic Psychiatry. He has one more recent book we'll mention in a bit. Toxic Psychiatry was published in 1991 by St. Martin's Press and has a British edition by HarperCollins. In Toxic Psychiatry, you say, I think you're quoting someone else, that 5 to 10 million or maybe more people are on neuroleptic drugs in the United States.
Right.
Is that a lot?
Well, it's just an enormous number of people because a large percentage of them are getting permanent brain damage. The rates of permanent disorders, just of the kind I've been discussing, where you get abnormal movements, 5% a year in the healthiest of patients. So let's say you have a strapping 30-year-old man. He's put on these drugs for 1 year. He has a 5% chance. It's astronomical. In 10 years, he has a 50% chance. It accumulates. If you're an older woman who gets these drugs, which is very common, let's say your mom is having a problem and she's getting old, she can't take care of herself, and with the best of intentions, you have her go into a nursing home. Well, the nursing home is not well staffed, let's say. They're irritable with these elderly people. They don't have the time and energy. So within a few months, the doctor suggests a little Haldol. Maybe doesn't even tell you. Just a little medicine, a tranquilizer, they tell you. And you think, oh, calming. Well, you're not told at all, which is also common. Now, your 65-year-old mother, and I'm not even talking about 85-year-old, your 65-year-old mother has a 20 to 30% chance of getting a permanent neurological disorder in the first year that she's on these drugs. And these are hard studies. I mean, I cite them in the book. I mean, this is not just some estimate from the top of my head. So when you talk about 10 million Americans on these drugs, let's say, and we don't know what the real figure is, but let's say for argument, it could be 10 to 20, but let's say 10 million Americans, including children and institutions and so on, we're talking about at least a million people with permanent brain damage and probably a lot more.
I want to ask you about the people who are given these drugs. Perhaps it is my mother in a nursing home. Perhaps it's an inmate in a prison. Perhaps it's someone in the society who has a mental disorder. I think we tend to think, in our kind of the basest part of ourselves, that someone who has a mental disorder is not like us. They are, to Martin Buber, they are the other, the them. Don't mm-hmm. have the same
right.
range of humanity that we have. First of all, why do we think that? And then I want to ask you what people with mental disorders really do look like.
Right. Well, we tend to believe at first because we're just afraid of anything that's called mental illness. That's been said again and again. If something is called that, we're very frightened by it. But we're also very frightened if somebody does behave in a strange way. I mean, if a person announces that they are Jesus, we don't take it in the same way as if they announce that they believe in Jesus. We take it somewhat differently. And that scares us. But another reason why we get confused about this is that psychiatrists speak with forked tongue about these issues. On the one hand, psychiatrists say, oh, don't stigmatize the mentally ill. All right? Well, that's a contradiction in terms. If you're going to label people, you stigmatize them. And then they say, and the mentally ill have genetic and biochemical disorders, but don't stigmatize the mentally ill. And who is going to believe that it's all nonsense, that there is no mental illness in terms of physical disease, there are no genetic defects, there are no biochemical defects, that the only biochemical imbalances in the brains of so-called mental patients are put in there by the psychiatrists with the awful drugs that they give to these patients?
Wait a minute, you've just dismissed 20 years of research.
No, 20 years of propaganda. There is no research. The research is all on the side that there are no biochemical or genetic disorders associated with any human problem, ordinary human problem, like being crazy or being angry or being upset or being immoral or stealing or lying or cheating on your wife or whatever, drinking, whatever the human problem is. I mean, clearly you can get brain damage and that limits your computer's capacities, limits the abilities to do things, but even brain-damaged people don't necessarily do bad things or crazy things or get wild or anything. And there is no indication. The research is all on the other side, and I review it in great detail in Toxic Psychiatry, and nobody's really going to debate me on this in America anymore. In fact, when I went to England, the head of the Royal Academy of Psychiatry debated me because they don't know me in England. And it was literally a debate, and he gave a 40-minute talk on how schizophrenia is biological and genetic and the neuroleptics help. And then I began my talk by asking him where he got the slides from that he had so cleverly shown. He didn't even know the studies he was citing the slides from. You see, it was just PR. So happened I knew where they were from. And when the debate was over, the audience decided, voted, and nobody voted for him as having a more cogent case. There were a few people undecided, and everybody else voted for me as having the cogent case. Why? Well, I'm a fairly good talker, but that's not really, I mean, you don't win an audience, a sophisticated audience like that. They don't have any data. The data is not confirming its claims. In the 70s, psychiatry decided to make a media campaign, and it has convinced intelligent people throughout the Western world that where there's smoke, there's fire. There must be something to these claims, and there simply aren't any. And in fact, they are the very claims psychiatry has made for 200 years. It's not like there was some new research. You see, psychiatrists are physicians. I'm a medical doctor. What else am I going to complain, claim? As a medical doctor, I can't see my future in claiming that it's caused by religious despair or child abuse or bad parents or economic times or existential despair. I'm not going to assign cause for something that I have no expertise in. I'm going to assign the cause to something that I'm in charge of, that I've been trained in, that I make my living at. Psychiatrists have always claimed these things are medical.
As an alternative theory, are those places the places where you think something like schizophrenia arises? Religious despair, child abuse, sexual abuse, economic conditions?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure I know the answers to the deepest problems in life. So, I mean, that might be a really nice place to start, that if I could tell you where everything comes from, boy, wouldn't I be the savior of the universe. And I can't tell you where everything comes from. But I can give you some general ideas.
Good. What's schizophrenia from your perspective?
First of all, it's a label. And that's very key. It's not a person. It's not a person, it's a label. So then you say, well, who gets labeled schizophrenic? To get labeled schizophrenic, the typical person who gets labeled it is saying really far out things. You don't get labeled schizophrenic if you say very dull things, like I hate you, or if you steal or cheat people. You get labeled schizophrenic if you say far out things like I'm God or I'm the Virgin Mary.
Dan Rather's in my head.
Dan Rather talks to me on the television. You know, you have to say outrageous, strange things. Well, who says those things? Well, they generally are said in the beginning by young people, i.e., so we say schizophrenia usually starts in adolescence or early youth, because young people say outrageous things. Adolescents think and feel in outrageous metaphors. So if you are a very spiritually oriented human being who thinks in metaphors, and who then gets very frightened and very helpless because your life is coming apart once you reach your teen years, and then you start communicating in these metaphors. And instead of saying, I hate my mother, I'd like to kill her, she's destroying me, you say, my mother has horns. Or instead of saying, I don't trust men are, my father abused me when I was 3 and I can't even remember it, but I'm frightened by men, you say, my father's colluding with the FBI. If you're speaking in outrageous metaphors, you get called schizophrenic. So my experience of young, say, women, say a 17-year-old woman who is really frightened and confused and hiding under her bed and saying she's being chased by people from outer space, when I talk to her, and maybe here's the key to my whole life, she makes a lot more sense to me often than her parents do. I understand what she's saying because I understand broken poetry and frightened poetry and frightened metaphors, and I try to connect spiritually. And before I know it, I'm usually in a conversation with this person about things that the family doesn't even know how to talk about. Her feelings of worthlessness, her feelings that there's no love in life, her feelings that life is just going to hurt her very, very badly, that there's no place for her to go. And I can end up communicating, you know, and so can a lot of other people. I mean, there's no magic about this. In fact, the less trained you are, the better you generally are at this, quite honestly, because you haven't got all this nonsense in your head that the psychiatrists are preaching. So people who get labeled schizophrenic tend to be very spiritually oriented people who are going through identity crises and are very frightened and are handling it helplessly and who get caught by psychiatrists. But if instead they entered a religious community that believed what they were saying, or if they kept it to themselves or whatever, they might have a much different outcome. And we have now research studies, controlled studies, that show if you take somebody labeled schizophrenic and put them in a mental hospital system with drugs and compare it to putting them in a residential home with caring human beings who aren't going to drug them, but who will be interested in them and supportive and try to reconnect them to the human community. Because basically when you're that disturbed, you're disconnected from the human community. What you need is a loving, caring reconnection with the human community. We have shown with studies that were originally funded by the National Institute of Mental Health that that's better than hospitals and drugs and less expensive. And those studies, after they were finished, the person who developed them, who was the director of the Center for Schizophrenia Studies in the government, was fired. Because to promote such a viewpoint is to undermine a multi-billion-dollar industry involving the National Institute of Mental Health, the Psychiatric Association, and the drug companies. In fact, that's how I got into psychiatry. I got in because I was going to be something else, a lawyer, professor of history and literature, something like that, at Harvard. I was going to Harvard. I was, you know, real intellectual kid. And I started working as a volunteer in mental hospitals. And I was struck by two things. One, how awful everybody was being treated. Awful. How callous and insensitive all the people who worked there were. You had to be that way. You quit or reform the place or do something drastic and get fired. And the other thing I was struck by is that we set up a program where everybody we worked with virtually, we got out of the hospital. I mean, here they were claiming these people had to be here. These people deserve lobotomies. These people, and we as college kids, by getting involved, by caring, by providing support, rarely psychotherapy, although some of them students, not me actually, but some of the students I supervised, they were doing psychotherapy basically under supervision with a social worker. We got most of the people out of the hospital, and these were back wards, supposedly burnt out schizophrenics. But what happened? Well, originally the program was written up. I mean, I had my picture as a kid in Look magazine, I think it was. No, it was Life magazine, Life or Look. And I used to go and lecture as a college student to professionals around the country. The President's Commission wrote this up as one of the big possible solutions for mental health in America. But that was the very moment the book came out in the early 60s, I was in college, 54 to 58, that was the very beginning when psychiatry realized if we promote this kind of stuff, we have no reason to exist. You don't need a psychiatrist to run a volunteer program that's getting people out of a hospital that the psychiatrists claim can't be helped. And so psychiatry systematically expurgated this kind of thing, and there were no more books or articles about the volunteer projects, no more funding of them after the 60s, because they totally undermine the claims of biological psychiatry.
You've called the field of psychiatry evil.
If I call psychiatry evil, it's only among close friends. It's not something I would do in writing. It depends on your definition of evil. If evil is sacrificing other human beings to your own ideology, then psychiatry is evil.
What happened to psychiatry, that it's caught up in its ideology?
It's the way psychiatry's always been. You see, this is not new. Psychiatry, remember, grew out of the state mental hospital system, out of locking up people and watching them deteriorate and making believe it was a medical problem.
This I hear from you. I am stopped by your description of the mental hospitals and of the young students who went in to volunteer.
Right.
These young students who went in to volunteer were not pure by comparison to cruel people.
Oh, yes, we were. Oh, yes. Cruelty grows with age and frustration and bitterness and money and cynicism. We were college sophomores. You can't be any dumber and purer than that. It's called sophomoric. I mean, I walk in the hospital and I'm talking to some psychiatrist and he says to me, and many of them had foreign accents in the state, particular state mental hospital. But he says to me basically, no, this thing you see where the patient's writhing on the floor, half dead from an overdose of insulin, is wonderful for the patient because it kills the bad brain cells and spares the good ones. And I look at him, and without 4 years of medical school, a year of internship, and 3 years of residency, this looks like nonsense. I have no investment in such nonsense. And when I saw people getting electroshock, or when they told me, oh, it doesn't matter that the wards are freezing in the winter, schizophrenics don't mind cold. And I would watch them huddle up in the corners, or lie on the half-dead radiators, or in the summer when people were sweltering in these dungeons, and I would say, this is terrible, and doctors say, oh, they don't mind the heat. And I knew they minded the heat. I minded the heat. See, I identified with them as human beings because I was a kid. I hadn't been trained in the separation. I hadn't been trained in feeling my white male patriarchal superiority yet. I hadn't gotten that whole shtick clearly elaborated. And in fact, I even fell victim to it for a while. I noticed myself in my training becoming authoritarian. I noticed myself thinking of people as having being different from me. But then I got control of myself again and realized I was buying a power structure. And I basically opted out of it and said, I'm not going to do it until I heard lobotomy was coming back. And then I said, well, I got to do more than just sit by and do therapy.
This is Dr. Peter Breggin on Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. Dr. Breggin's early books, actually the first book that he wrote, co-authored with some fellow students, was College Students in a Mental Hospital, an account of organized social contacts between college volunteers and mental patients in a hospital community. The book was published in 1962. In 1979, he published Electroshock, Its Brain Disabling Effects, a book that was translated into German, French, Italian, and made a Behavioral Sciences Book Club selection. The Psychology of Freedom followed in 1980, subtitled Liberty and Love as a Way of Life. And in 1983, the precursor to toxic psychiatry, Psychiatric Drugs, Hazards to the Brain. His latest book on this topic, the topic of our discussion today, Toxic Psychiatry, its subtitle, Why Therapy, Empathy, and Love Must Replace Drugs, Electroshock, and Biochemical Theories of the New Psychiatry. St. Martin's Press published it in 1991. A latest book is called Beyond Conflict, From Self-Help and Psychotherapy to Peacemaking, also a St. Martin's book, published in 1992. I'm Susan McGinnis once again. This is Conversations. Dr. Breggin, I want to ask you about what I think to be mental problems of the 90s. Might be wrong, but it seems to me that they belong to this decade. One is manic depression, and the other is hyperactivity in kids. Are these kind of the disease of the day?
Well, manic depression has a long history, but hyperactivity is a disease of the day. Hyperactivity is what we accuse children of when we don't want to be responsible for their lives.
This is not a syndrome.
Nah.
This is not a defect.
No. The scientific studies, which I review, and I review them carefully in Toxic Psychiatry, all indicate there's no disease. You can't identify it. You can't treat it. It's all a pack of nonsense generated for the business of psychiatry. This one really makes me angry.
There's a lot of children on Ritalin.
Yes, this one really, really makes me angry. I just came back from England, and Ritalin isn't even in the formulary in England. There's a formulary of drugs that people who work in the National Health Service can give in England. So if you're basically in the health system in England and you go to a doctor for your child, the doctor can't give your child Ritalin. And that's a drug we consider indispensable. And they're just against the drugging of children because they like their children in England. I'm very angry and bitter about this. This is such a cultural phenomena, this giving up of responsibility for our kids. There isn't a one of us as an adult who would like to be a child today in our families. This one really makes me angry. We end up in situations where our children, our 10-year-old boys, watch violent movies. They're taught to be macho. They're taught to disrespect women. Then we put them into situations of fatherless homes where the father's either out working or has gone and married somebody else a second time. So here's a woman that the child's been taught to disrespect by the media, trying to raise him. He then goes off to a classroom of 30 children where another woman is trying to tell him what to do, and we expect in this situation then when our little boys won't settle down and do what they're told, when they're upset and tense and nervous, can't wait to get out of class, to call that a disease is such a rejection of responsibility for our kids.
You have just told me a number of things about gender and circumstance. Is this about gender and circumstance? Are male children hyperactive rather than female children?
That's right. Yeah, and by 9 to 1 or 6 to 1, depending on your study, it's boys rather than girls who are getting labeled hyperactive and getting these drugs. And a lot of these irresponsible responsible doctors, including doctors at NIMH, are claiming that 10 to 15% of boys should be on drugs. I mean, what statement is this about us as adults? It says nothing about our children. It declares us to be so irresponsible as a nation that we accept this kind of conduct. And it's a selling process. SIBA, the company that makes Ritalin, gives millions of dollars to psychiatry, to organize psychiatry, sponsors symposia, and psychiatrists respond, because really, what does a psychiatrist have to offer? I mean, let's face it. What does 4 years of medical school, a year of internship, and 3 years on psychiatric wards give you to help a woman who comes to your office with a 10-year-old boy that she can't relate to? Well, you're probably not relating to your own kids either as a psychiatrist. It's not exactly a profession that encourages warmth, caring, and involvement with your own family. So here we have this group of so-called experts, my colleagues, on children who know nothing about children. You read the books on hyperactivity and you'll find children are missing. There is nothing about love for kids. There's no wonderment over kids. There's no praise of kids. It's about diagnosing kids. And to grow up today is such a feat. To grow up with the confused values, the broken families, the overcrowded schools, the cutback in fundings, and to think that we're supposed to respond to that as physicians by drugging children instead of representing children, instead of standing up for children and in trying to get them the services they need, the caring they need, the basic elements that they need. And this is not parent blaming. I mean, I wouldn't want to be a woman, single, raising children in this society for anything, especially not a couple of 10-year-old boys or one 10-year-old boy. This is a fact of life about being children, and there's absolutely no reason to call any of this stuff diseases and no reason to give any of these children drugs.
What's Ritalin doing that is making the parents and the doctors and the mental health community feel that these children are getting help?
It spaces kids out. You're not as in touch with yourself. You're not as in touch with your anger. You're not as in touch with your loneliness. You're not as in touch with how boring school is. They could have the kids smoking dope just as well, and it would be less damaging, because there's no evidence that dope causes brain damage. None, although I'm totally against it. People smoking it, but now we're getting evidence that people on Ritalin for years and years are developing brain damage. I mentioned at least one of the studies in toxic psychiatry. Ritalin is speed. It's amphetamine. And in fact, they use amphetamines instead of Ritalin in lots of the kids in the U.S. And in fact, the latest study out of NIMH that I've seen claims there's no difference between using straight amphetamine, dexedrine, or using Ritalin. They're so closely related. No difference at all. Here's a drug that stunts height and weight, and as far as I know, I'm the only psychiatrist to stand up and say, what does that mean about the brain? Why would I be the only psychiatrist to wonder if you're stunting height and weight, or at least retarding it, at least retarding its growth, what does it mean about the brain? Why am I the only psychiatrist? Because I'm not vested anymore in this biochemical industrial complex that surrounds this whole business. I don't think we should ever give drugs to kids. This is a manufactured disorder. Manic depression is a much more complicated issue, but I think it's fundamentally the same thing. But it's something that's been around much longer. People have talked about extreme highs and lows since the Greeks. And you can trace the development of trying to figure out what it is and understand it. And it was defined, actually, in 1899 by Kreplin as manic depressive disorder. So, I mean, you can watch the development evolution. Now, what do you think psychiatrists said about manic depressive disorder in the 19th century? They said it's biochemical and genetic. Mm. You see, it's not a fact. It's something we say. And we said it then, because what is Kreplin going to say, a psychiatrist who's got these people in hospital? Is he going to say, well, actually, these people have nothing to do with my training. They have nothing to do with my knowledge. I don't know why they're the way they are. Maybe it's spiritual. Maybe it's psychological. He's not going to say that. So if you go back and you read Kreplin, he says it's genetic and biochemical, and we've been saying it ever since, and we've never proven it. Now, I have my own ideas about why people get extremely high and extremely low. I get the same thing. If I watch a ball game, I'm rooting for somebody, so I have no problem with why somebody gets wildly out of control high and then wildly depressed. If you can do it over a ball game, my God, you can do it over your life.
Wildly elated, my side's winning. Wildly depressed, my side's losing.
That's right. Not translated into wildly elated because really I don't want to face how depressed I am. Mm. Translated into my life is not the life I want, and I can't face it, and I can't deal with it. And it's, to me, easily understandable that people go from one extreme to another. But that's my view. I can't prove that. We're having a heck of a time proving whatever the origins are of people who get into such extremes. But to me, it's just an extreme. I'm an extreme person. I do extreme things like stand up to the whole National Institute of Mental Health. I don't think that being extreme deserves a biochemical diagnosis. To me, it's a part of life.
What does Prozac do to someone who has manic depression or the class of drugs that Prozac is representative of?
Well, you're going to be very careful about giving Prozac to anybody who's said to be manic depressive, mm-hmm. because, in fact, Prozac can produce mania. I mean, 1-3%. I mean, it's not even unheard of or extremely rare. It can produce a very manic, hyper kind of behavior, including, in my experience, violent behavior. Because Prozac has a stimulant effect. Now, one of the interesting things, and to be able to have an hour like this to bring up some of these more subtle issues, when Prozac was going through the approval process at the FDA, and this will give you an example of what the collusion is with the drug companies and the FDA. When it was going through FDA approval, the chief person responsible for doing a summary of side effects, this was the doctor who did for the FDA the side effect profile of the drug from all the studies. He said, this is a stimulant drug. This is a stimulant profile. People get energized. They get hyper. They lose weight. This is what happens on amphetamines. And he said this twice in his write-up, in the beginning and at the end. Well, the FDA edited it out. Why would they edit it out? Because they would be told very quickly that if they called it this, that would ruin the sale of the drug. Because doctors would quickly say, stimulant, that means addiction, it means getting hyper, it means crashing, getting depressed, it might mean getting suicidal, it might mean getting violent. That is, it might mean everything that's been reported in the press about Prozac. And then what do you do when the reports come up? Well, then what does the FDA do? Are they going to betray their drug companies because the FDA is hand in glove with the drug companies? Are they going to look like darn fools who are betraying the public? No. They get a special committee together to say, well, this is all false. How do they do that? Well, I fax the FDA. They know me very well because my work has forced them to do a number of things they haven't wanted to do over the years. So I faxed the FDA. I said, I'd like to come make a report in your committee because I can not only verify that patients are getting suicidal and homicidal on the drug, I can explain the potential biochemical mechanisms of it. And I'm like, 5 minutes. The FDA doesn't even respond. Mm. That's how all of this takes place because there are billions of dollars at stake. It's sad. It's true.
Dr. Peter Breggin is our guest today on Conversations. His private practice is a full-time private practice in psychiatry, working with adults and children and couples and families. He is also the director of the Center for the Study of Psychiatry in Bethesda, Maryland. That is a network of psychiatrists, other mental health professionals, attorneys, patient rights advocates, and members of U.S. Congress. He has been the director of this center since 1972. In his spare time, Dr. Breggin is an adjunct professor of conflict analysis and resolution at George Mason University and has several medical and psychiatric consultancies, one of which is in Alaska. He is a psychiatric consultant to the Alaska Youth Initiative Program and to Advocacy Services of Alaska. Both organizations have offices in Fairbanks and in Anchorage. These two organizations have brought Dr. Peter Breggin to Alaska on this visit. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. I would like to turn from criticism to solutions. I think the word solutions, maybe you may find the word solutions too strong, but alternatives to chemicals, alternatives to psychiatric mm-hmm. surgery. If we take a look, and perhaps we should take a look first at a child who is diagnosed with some sort of hypercondition, how would you deal with this child in your private practice?
Well, I do that. The first thing I do is undo the damage. So I get together with the child and the family, not with the child alone, because I don't want the child thinking that he's got something wrong with him, that he's caused all his problems by himself. So I have him come in with the family. And just recently, a young boy came in, and I asked him if he knew why he was coming to me. And he said, well, he heard that they were trying to make him take drugs at school, and his mommy and daddy wanted him to come see me, and 'cause I was not a doctor who didn't like to do that. I said, fine. He said, they're doing it to me for my ADHD.
What is an ADHD?
It's a attention deficit hyperactive disorder.
And this came from the lips of a child who is how old?
7, maybe. Mm,
goodness.
It's ADHD. I said, well, let me tell you another secret about me as a doctor. Said, I will call him Jimmy. I said, Jimmy, I'll tell you another secret. I also don't do that to kids. I don't give them names like ADHD. I've already talked to your mom and dad, and I know there's nothing wrong with you. You're just a kid who's got problems around him. You got problems in your family that you're trying to work out, and they're trying to work out problems at school. And you're not the cause of all this, so you're not basically the problem. And so I'm not going to give you a label. So I don't give drugs and I don't give labels. What I'm going to do is try to help things work out. And then we talk some more. And then I gave him a magic wand, and I have a little magic wand. They said, now you can point this at your mom and dad, and you can ask them for anything you want in the way of their changing. I can't guarantee they'll do it, but they have promised me they would listen and talk about it. And the little boy pointed the wand at his dad and asked his dad to be a dad, basically, which followed right on my having seen the family alone and having said, Dad, you need to get more involved with your boy. He's out of control. He's upset. He's frightened. He doesn't have the presence of a father, and he's full of energy, and he doesn't know how to control it himself. And so the boy and I made the same diagnosis. Now, under those conditions, you can affect change in a child in one session. You can almost never do that with an adult. Dramatic change in one session. But since a child is dependent upon adults, when you have well-meaning adults who suddenly see the light, and the father on the spot, let's say, decides A, never to hit his child ever again, and B, to start taking him out to McDonald's every Sunday and to get more involved with his life and to work on it with a therapist, the kid brightens up immediately. That particular family called me the next day or two and said, Jimmy was singing in the car on the way home. Now, life gets more complicated than that. If the injuries are very deep and the parents are difficult, you have a whole different problem. But the problem is not the child, it's the difficult parents, or the difficult school, or the teacher who hates kids, or what was done to him in school 3 years earlier that he can't get over. So the problem may get much more difficult than that, but not because the child was born difficult, but was born into difficulty.
We don't come into this life broken, then.
Oh, no, not psychiatrically broken. We may come in with a bad hand or foot, but not psychiatrically broken. There's no evidence at all for it. And the notion that people come into life broken has always been used to blame victims. Black people are supposed to come into life with less intelligence. Women are supposed to come in so they can't be president of the United States because of their cycles. Children come in, you know, genetically defective. We're always, in psychiatry has been the leading edge of this, we're always taking people who are born into trouble within the society or the family and blaming them. That's psychiatry in the service of power. My wife, Ginger, and I have spent much of this year destroying a $400 million federal program. That we succeeded is an incredible tribute to America, that two people could actually do something like this. But we stumbled on the fact that the National Institute of Mental Health was planning to identify little black children in the inner city on a mass scale on the grounds that they were biologically and genetically defective, and that's why they were going to grow up and be violent. A straightforward racist program produced by Frederick Goodwin, the director of the National Institute of Mental Health. In fact, this is so bizarre that we give out free information on it, if I can give a phone number. If you want to call from Alaska to Bethesda, Maryland, 301-652-5580, ask for the VIP pack. That's the Violence Initiative Program. Violence Initiative Project PAC, VIP. Just ask for the VIP when you get my answering service, and we'll mail you a package that costs us a buck or two to send out, because we are determined they're not going to get away with labeling America's black children as defective, because the miracle of black children is that they're so wonderful despite white people. I mean, that's a miracle. That is a miracle. And despite the conditions that so many of them are raised in. And if the government's going to study anything, I want them to study how come the black community manages to give us such wonderful music, such wonderful art, such wonderful sports, such wonderful political leadership, such incredible moral leaders like Martin Luther King, when we disadvantage them all the time. I mean, that's what I'd like to study. I think this is a terrible situation. So really, led by Ginger Breggin, we took on what turned out to be a piece of a massive funding project called the Youth Violence Prevention Initiative, of which only a small part was the part we were against. But we fought so hard against that small part, which was the inner city violence initiative, the one directed at the black people, that the whole thing collapsed when it was going to be Bush's major answer for the cities. I mean, this was astonishing. And in fact, this week, Science Magazine has a follow-up story on it for those people who get that magazine, describing to some extent our role in this, and to some extent describing the issues. But we'll be happy to send that a package out about that to people.
Okay. Once again, Dr. Peter Breggin on KUAC. This is Conversations. Among our listeners may be a mother whose child, or father whose child, is on Ritalin and who does not have access to a psychiatrist who feels and believes as you do. What would you say to those parents?
I would say, if you have a troubled, upset child, don't define the problem as psychiatric. Think other ways. And the first thing that a parent needs to do who has an upset child is take total responsibility for it. You don't say, I'm a bad parent, because maybe you're also a good parent. I mean, your kid is maybe wonderful, but has a problem. So you're an everything parent, just like I'm an everything. I'm a good and a bad parent. I have four children, 14 to 31, so I've done a lot of good and bad things over the years. And redefine the problem. So the first thing you want to do is get some sort of help, if you can, in being a better parent. I mean, that's step number one. Very likely you're a single mother. I mean, this turns up again and again with these kids who are getting drugged. So you want to find a way to get a male influence into your child's life. Maybe there's a big brother program. Maybe there's a counseling program. Maybe there isn't. Maybe you have to go find one. Maybe as a teenager who would like to become a friend to your little boy. I'm just assuming that we use the paradigmatic child here, the 10-year-old boy who's about to be put on Ritalin, or who's been put on Ritalin. So redefine the problem as not medical. Then when you go to school and they want to give your child drugs, remind them that, and this is very common, that your kid does fine over the summer. So how can it be a disease? It's obviously a convenience, and that you are going to refuse to put your child on Ritalin, and if necessary, you'll go to Advocacy Services of Alaska or some other legal source, the public defender, and fight. Refuse. Don't let the school bully you. And then say, now let's talk about my son's needs. his basic needs. Obviously, he's uncomfortable in class or he's having trouble focusing. He says, can I come to class for a while? If you can do that, if you're a mom who's not working full time, can one of my relatives come to class and just kind of keep an eye on things, sit in the back of the room maybe, and see what's going on, see if we can help calm him down. What could you maybe think about whether another teaching approach would work with him? Or maybe next year he could have a man teacher. I heard there's going to be a man teacher next year, because a boy that who won't show respect for women, which is very unfortunate, but trained into children, boy children, might be a prince with a male teacher, because this is not a disease. So basically what I would urge is, don't think medically about your child's personal or behavioral problems. Think family, think school, think that you're in charge. Think that you got to figure out some approach to understanding what is frustrating your child, what is making your kid unhappy, what is this child's, and what you can do to help correct that.
We have moments left. Is this tack appropriate for adults as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the problem basically is the medicalization of fundamentally social, psychological, spiritual, and in the case of little black children, political problems. It's, you can't bring medicine in and define human problems as medical without doing a lot of damage. So my job is to help people rethink the basic problems they're facing and to try to look at them in the context of life, of how people relate to each other, what people do to each other, what people can do to help each other out.
Your suggestions are suggestions, I think, which would take a great deal of time and potentially uncover things people might not want to look at. Is that one of the reasons that drug therapy is attractive?
Well, I think there's a top-down and a bottom-down reason drug treatment's attractive. Drug treatment is attractive to the recipients of it when it is, which is not as often as you might think. A lot of it's PR and coercion from psychiatrists. But it's attractive to the people who get it because it relieves by dulling. And it's no different than smoking dope. It's no different than taking alcohol. Just because the doctor gives you a pill doesn't mean now it has a special quality. I mean, all drugs can do is make it harder for us to be ourselves. And some of us really feel that's our only solution. I don't ever want to do that as a therapist. I mean, if you choose it personally, that's up to you, but I don't want to do it. So that's where it comes from the bottom. From the top, giving drugs has many causes. A multi-billion dollar industry, the identity and work of psychiatrists who don't know how to do anything else, a society that thinks technology is the answer. I mean, it just comes from a lot of reasons, and basically we need a more caring society. We have to start with loving our kids, taking responsibility for our children, having a more of a community view of each other. We need a whole different approach than the medical one.
Thanks. Dr. Peter Breggin, our guest today on Conversations. One last note, Dr. Peter Breggin is a member of the American Psychiatric Association, the Canadian Psychiatric Association, the Psychiatric Society of Washington, as well as a number of other professional organizations, including the National Association for Rights, Protection, and Advocacy. The most recent books, Toxic Psychiatry, published by St. Martin's Press in 1991, and then Beyond Conflict, From Self-Help and Psychotherapy to Peacemaking, also a St. Martin's book, published in 1992. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. Thanks very much, Peter Breggin. I hope you'll join me again next week.